So I would also like to thank Alain and Ariel for inviting me to this fantastic symposium. I cannot stop taking notes because everything is so interesting. And I couldn't have asked for a better introduction to my part than Alexander's talk, which fits right in. And you will see why in a minute. But I just wanted to start by introducing the current members of in my lab, and you will see a few of them scattered around for things that they have done. So my lab is interested in the pathophysiology of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And we have been, although we are kind of spreading and taking over territory, we started working with the amygdala. It is particularly important for these disorders. As you know, it is really at the core of circuits that are that encode salience and biological value, the most well-learned paradigm being fear learning, of which we have heard quite a bit, but it's actually involved in encoding pretty much any sort of biological value, and therefore it has thought to be to play quite an important role in these disorders. We have also worked on the entorhinal cortex and a little bit on the perirhinal cortex. As you know, there is also already evidence in these disorders that it is involved. And as you know, it processes information from large parts of the cerebral cortex and sends them back to the hippocampus, which also has been shown to be involved. We more recently have started working on the thalamus, particularly the mediodorsal nucleus of the thalamus, but I will show data that Kim Doe was referring to. We have developed some work together on a nucleus right at the lateral edge of the thalamus, the thalamic reticular nucleus, which is particularly important, not very much well studied in schizophrenia, at least not in postmortem, but there is very interesting data, for instance, from electrophysiology, so that among many other things, this nucleus generates sleep spindles, which have been found to be affected in schizophrenia and in part in bipolar disorder. But it has also a much broader role in gating the connectivity between the prefrontal or the cortex and the thalamus, or rather more specifically from the thalamus to the cortex, and therefore plays a really important role in things like focused attention. So very quickly, why do we study bipolar and schizophrenia together? Is because there is quite a bit of evidence genetically, pharmacologically, pathologically, and so on, that these disorders are really sort of along a clinical continuum. So you, in clinical work, you very rarely find a textbook bipolar disorder case or similar with schizophrenia. They're usually along a continuum in which you can find a mix of different symptoms. So we are beginning to think that, in fact, it is important to study them all and try to understand what is the overlap from a pathology point of view. And they in common share an onset during late adolescence or early adulthood. There are some slight differences. Bipolar can typically has a little broader of a range, but that is roughly the critical time. They both have a strong genetic component with a very high heritability, and they in both there have been shown to be multiple neural circuits that are involved. So if you put them all together, sort of maturation of neural circuit in postnatal development, genetic components that may affect the neurodevelopment, and the fact that we know that several brain regions that are interconnected are affected, brought together or raised the question of whether these are really disorders of neural connectivity. And what I'm going to try to make a point is that the extracellular matrix could contribute to this altered connectivity in these disorders. So you heard quite a bit of it already about the matrix, but I'm going to make a couple of points that are sort of relevant to my talk. The extracellular matrix surrounds all neural cells in our brain. It's has been estimated to be about 20% of the volume of our brain. So it's actually a big player. We didn't know what to make of it until many of the people in the room started studying it more seriously and started understanding what are its properties. But it's definitely there around all cells. We know that it has a sort of, within the brain, the backbone of the matrix is really hyaluronan, which is composed by glucuronic acid and then acetylglucosamine. So, and it forms this very, very long chain in the extracellular space. And attached to these chains are CSPGs, which is most of what we have studied so far, although it is clear that it's not all that there is there to be studied, and they're, as you know, linked by link proteins. And something that has been brought up already, but I'm going to make a point of it because I'm going to talk a little bit about it, is that it seems like where the game really is, what gives function to these molecules, is really sulfation patterns. And although there are different combinations, I'm going to just point out the two main ones, which is the CS6 and the CS4 sulfation pattern on the N-acetylgalactosamine. And this slide is to show where some of these sulfation patterns may be. There can be anywhere in any of this chain, both proximally and distally. But we have been using antibodies that pick up certain sulfation patterns, particularly CS6. So when I'm going to refer to CS56 is an antibody that picks up a sulfation 6 around this part of a chain, supposedly, 3B3 more, perhaps more distally, unless you use enzymes to break down the chains. And one that you have heard quite a bit about is an actual lectin, is not an antibody, that is known to bind to an acetylgalactosamine, but we don't really understand what characteristics of the sugar chains have to be there in order for WFA to bind. So we initially, very naively, in my lab, thought that it would bind to all CSPGs. That's obviously not the case. It is not clear to us, and if anybody knows, please do tell us, because we have a lot of data on it and we would love to understand it better. Our suspicion, it might be that it is an unsulfated form, but we really don't have any hard evidence for that. So if you put together some of these elements, you see that these chains of hyaluronan and CSPGs with the link proteins and held together by tenascin create this molecular network in our brain. And if you scale it, you see that it is all over, obviously, but it forms coating around certain neurons, or perhaps all neurons, depending on what kind of elements you're looking at. And there is a very strong interaction with glial cells, both in the sense that probably a lot of the components of the matrix are synthesized by glial cells and secreted in the extracellular space, and they might end up as components of the perineuronal nets. But this also, as we have been hearing quite a bit, is around a lot of the synapses, which are also surrounded by processes by astrocytes with this tetrapartite synapse that very elegantly Alexander was describing and has described in his papers. So we talked quite a bit about perineuronal net. As you know, they have been described in 1893 by Camillo Golgi, but for a long time they sort of stay there dormant until much, much more recently. And so this is an example in the human brain of perineuronal nets labeled with WFA. And in fact, although there are some species-specific differences, which I will mention, WFA perineuronal nets tend to be associated, at least predominantly, with parvalbumin-positive neurons, which is what I'm showing here. So when I got into this business, I actually got in it by chance, because I thought I could use WFA perineuronal net as a marker for parvalbumin, which turned out not to be the case, but opened a whole field of investigations. Now, part of the difficulty, in addition to all the possibilities on the types of the molecules in the matrix and the sulfation patterns and other cleavage forms of CSPGs, is that there are some important differences. So perineuronal nets is not one creature, but in fact there are many. But there are other elements in the brain that express molecules. One that I mentioned is astrocytes, which you can find labeled in with the WFA, but specifically in human, it's very hard, and or we couldn't actually find them, not even in rhesus monkeys, so we could detect perineuronal nets quite nicely, but not these glial cells, which turn out to co-express GFAP, so there may be some important differences that are related to species-specific in how much of these CSPGs are expressed in different cell types. There are other important differences. For instance, it has been shown in rodents that the great majority of valbumin-positive neurons have perineuronal nets and vice versa. This is actually not completely true in human. So this is, for instance, for perineuronal nets, we had about 56% in the human amygdala that had parvalbumin, and another 12 that had parvalbumin and calbindin, but about 32% didn't have either, which is much higher than it had been shown in rodents. And the same thing, perhaps even more striking with the parvalbumin-positive neurons, of which not that many actually had perineuronal nets. Similarly, as I mentioned, we are working also on the thalamus and in the thalamic reticular nucleus. There is a population of parvalbumin-positive neurons that have nets, but only 20% about are associated with nets, and about 63% of nets are with the parvalbumin. So obviously there are differences, which is to be expected. It's also important to notice that there is region specificity even within a species. So this is from mouse, and showing in different color, green is agrican, brevican is in blue, and tenascin is in red, that there is quite a bit of heterogeneity if you look at different brain regions. And finally, to make things even more interesting, within the human brain, there are morphological differences, which we don't know, my lab, much about, but they are interesting. So this is both WFA perineuronal nets, but this is in the amygdala, this is in the reticular nucleus of the thalamus, and you can see they look very, very different, despite the fact that the cells they are associated with are actually very similar morphologically. But what we do believe is that, independently of the morphology, what this net appearance is given, as Alexander was just saying, by the fact that the perineuronal nets are probably nothing other than perisynaptic organized aggregates of extracellular matrix. And so we came up with the idea of, as a field, I mean, that perineuronal nets, because they are perisynaptic aggregates, might contribute to an aspect of disconnectivity in schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and more specifically on a disruption of synaptic connectivity. And you had several really important examples in the previous talk. This is just a slide to show that synaptic connectivity or synaptic dysfunction has been postulated to be affected in several brain disorders, starting from autism spectrum disorder, here in pink, in which there may be an increase of synapses due to defective pruning, Alzheimer, in which there may be a normal course, except that they might drop sooner, perhaps something that has to do with the work that James Fawcett was mentioning, and then schizophrenia, in which there seemed to be a sharper decrease near the clinical onset of schizophrenia that may continue throughout the course. And there are several different examples of how synapses are affected in these disorders. This is work by David Lewis, who has worked, as you know, on parvalbumin-positive neurons, as they might be involved in schizophrenia. And this is a bit difficult to read as a slide, but the main point is that they counted in this work the density of VGLUT1 plus PSD95, so basically the synapses on parvalbumin-positive neurons, and they were significantly decreased here in red in people with schizophrenia versus versus normal control. And this matched a decrease of expression of parvalbumin itself. So what they are postulating is that there is a decrease of expression of parvalbumin, not a decrease of neurons, because they are the same numbers, but they are expressing less parvalbumin because they are getting less excitatory inputs because they have less synapses on them. As I'm going to show you another few examples just to make the point that the field is really moving toward thinking that a disruption of synaptic connectivity could be one of the key pathological features of these disorders. It could be very well, again, of other disorders I mentioned, autism spectrum, depression has very similar findings, but that may go with the idea that these are not really categorical disorders, but we should look at clinical domains. So in this is from a GWAS study, and this is a Manhattan plot on sites of vulnerability. And what was really striking is that by far the strongest site harbors a gene for C4, which is the complement component C4. And some work that came out recently from Stephen McCarroll lab showed that the human C4 protein localizes a neuronal synapses, dendrite, and axons, and it in mice, C4-mediated synapse elimination, so they postulated that excessive complement activity during development due to this genetic vulnerability could contribute to decreases of synapses in schizophrenia. Other classic work has shown that there is in fact a decrease in dendritic spines, so in pyramidal neurons, for instance, in the prefrontal cortex, when people counted painstakingly dendritic spines in controls, they find that in schizophrenics and in bipolar disorder, perhaps to a lesser extent, these are decreased, again, with the idea that there may be a decrease in synapses or something profoundly wrong with them. So we know, and again, we heard very compelling evidence before my talk, that... I got ahead of myself. So the other work, particularly by David Lewis, has shown that it is really some of the molecular signaling that are within synapses that are compromised in schizophrenia, again, to show where these changes may be and whether they may be associated, for instance, with the microtubules within the dendritic spines. And here is where I was trying to get to, which is that a lot of these components are, in fact, components that interact strongly with the extracellular matrix. So if you link the two, the question would be, would extracellular matrix abnormalities contribute, or might they contribute to synaptic disruption? It has been shown in many ways. I probably don't need to show all this because you saw quite compelling evidence in the previous talk. But extracellular matrix has also been shown to affect dendritic spine motility, quite compelling because of its relevance to schizophrenia. It has been shown to affect glutamatergic transmission, and I had tried to make a cartoon of findings in Frischnet and Feisner's lab, which is, again, it's relevant to schizophrenia because in schizophrenia we know that glutamatergic transmission is affected. So the idea is that it is part of the function of perisynaptic extracellular matrix, may regulate a particular aspect of synaptic transmission, which is synaptic desensitization. So in here you have in red the representation of perisynaptic matrix, postsynaptic receptors, and this is meant to be vesicles with glutamate. So the idea is that once the synapse becomes active and glutamate comes out, some of the postsynaptic receptors become desensitized, and this contributes to turning off the synapse and make it react more to further glutamate. But what has been shown is that if you get rid of the extracellular matrix, you allow the sensitized receptors to swim out and to be replaced by fresh receptors. Therefore, you don't get this synaptic desensitization. In addition, you allow potentially the molecules, because you're changing the properties of the matrix of glutamate, perhaps to swim out of the synaptic space. So another important factor that made us think that perhaps the matrix is affected in these disorders is that perineuronal nets and probably other forms of extracellular matrix do seem to mature late in postnatal development, which could potentially match the periods of prodromal sort of subclinical manifestations in these disorders. And similar to what has been shown in the visual cortex and in other brain regions, and I point out this in particular because it is in the by Gogola et al. And Caroni, because it is in the amygdala, which is one of the brain regions we ended up studying. But it is really interesting work, so it's related to the closure of critical periods, but in the amygdala, the idea would be that there is a form of juvenile plasticity that is, for instance, related to fear learning that is very different from the mature form of plasticity. So as you know, in fear conditioning, the animals learn to associate a conditioned stimulus to pain. But if you extinguish it, if you present the conditioned stimulus over and over and over without the painful stimuli, eventually the animal will learn, and so will we, that what was a conditioned stimulus is now safe, but this is a weak memory that only partially masks the previous learning of danger. And in fact, it is easily wiped off. You just have to wait long enough or change the context or stress the animal a bit, and the memory of the fear, so the conditioned stimulus representing danger, will come back very quickly. This is actually not true, it turns out, in juvenile animals, in which extinction completely wipes out the previous memory of danger. And the transition between these two periods seems to be marked by the maturation of perineuronal nets within the amygdala. So similar to experiments in the visual cortex that Tommaso and his lab did, if you wipe out, if you put chondrinase ABC in the amygdala, you reinstate a more juvenile form of plasticity. Again, interesting from our point of view, because if there was a change in perineuronal nets in the amygdala, you could think that the encoding of the meaning of a certain stimulus would be very difficult to be created correctly in these patients. So together again, we thought that the extracellular matrix may be involved in psychiatric disorders, and we proceeded to test that. And this is just to show a little bit of what are the things we need to pay attention to when we do. So this is all work done in postmortem human tissue. So you have to think about a lot of possible factors that might affect your data. So we obviously match them for the obvious potential confounds, and but also look at many other things, particularly exposure to pharmacological treatment, including antipsychotics, lithium, SSRIs, valproic acid, exposure to ECTs, and a whole series of potential substance abuse, from nicotine and alcohol to amphetamine and cocaine and so on and so forth. So what did we find? So the first set of study I'm going to show you is all based on labeling with WFA, which is why I want to know so badly what exactly it labels, and it might not be the right question to ask, but so this is just example. This is a block of the human brain containing the amygdala, the anterior part of the hippocampus and the entorhinal cortex, in a person with schizophrenia in any control, and the black labeling is WFA. You see very, very clearly that there is quite an amazing difference between controls and schizophrenics. When I show this picture in a grant and I sent it to NIH, apparently somebody at NIH said that I had taken a Sharpie and made up all the changes by coloring it up. And the reason for that is because you actually, in these disorders, never really see these huge, big changes. They're usually very, very subtle. And seeing something like this was so unusual that they thought I had faked it. But it is real, I promise, and this is just to show in this is a part of the entorhinal cortex. But what seems to be a huge increase is actually a two-way change. So in fact, WFA labeled perineuronal nets are decreased in both the amygdala and the entorhinal cortex of subjects with schizophrenia. So you see it here only in the lateral part, because again, this in human, although to a lesser extent, they mostly label pervalbumin positive neurons, which are mostly in the lateral nucleus of the amygdala, so that's where we found our change. But they were also changed in decreased, in fact, in parts of the entorhinal cortex. And the reason I'm pointing out the lateral entorhinal cortex in bipolar disorder is because there is no change. And this was interesting to us because it was the only part in which we actually found a decrease of pervalbumin positive neurons. So the only spot where there wasn't a decrease of perineuronal nets, there was a decrease of pervalbumin positive neurons. While in any other nucleus of the amygdala and of the entorhinal cortex, in other words, pervalbumin neurons did not change in number. They were the same numbers in schizophrenia, bipolar, and controls, making the point that the decrease in perineuronal nets does not depend on the fact that there are less neurons. The neurons are there, you can find them, but it is the perineuronal nets that are decreasing. The other striking change, however, was the number of glial cells labeled with WFA, and the sort of assumption here, which we haven't completely tested, is that we are finding the glia to be labeled because they are synthesizing and eventually secreting out CSPGs. But these were the really striking changes, so those amazing increases that you found in those two example sections actually reflect very striking increases of glial cells labeled with WFA for CSPGs. And again, as it has been found over and over and over in these disorders, there is no astrocytosis. There is no an increase in glial cells in these disorders. So the number of CSPGs or WFA-labeled glial cells may reflect an increase in expression or perhaps lack of secretion, but it's not due to an increase in these cells specifically. And we have done a little bit kind of trying to follow up on trying to understand, okay, what are we seeing with WFA? With mRNA, we looked at several different CSPGs, and if anything, we found an increase of mRNA, perhaps because we were looking at glial cells, but then the question comes of why the perineuronal nets are decreased. We found similar results in other brain regions. This is in collaboration with Wilson Wu, who is also at Harvard Medical School and McLean Hospital. So this is the prefrontal cortex in control and schizophrenia. You see a decrease in perineuronal nets, perhaps not as striking as in the amygdala, but it's definitely there. And the one that this is actually submitted but not yet published, in collaboration with Kim Do and her group, is looking at the TRN, the thalamic reticular nucleus. So here we had two big surprises. One is that there is a decrease of perineuronal nets, but is equal in schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and it's quite significant. And just to remind you, the TRN is in red here, so it's this sort of shell that surrounds the lateral sides of the thalamus. But the other big surprise is that, remember, so far what we found is that there is no decrease in parvalbumin-positive neurons, but there is a decrease in perineuronal nets. But when we did look at parvalbumin-positive neurons in the TRN, actually we did find an even more substantial decrease in both schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And this is particularly relevant for the reasons I was mentioning earlier on, which is that the TRN would affect, or abnormalities in the TRN may affect several functions that are thought to be involved in symptoms of schizophrenia and bipolar disorders, such as encoding contest and salient and generating sleep spindles. So as a summary for our WFA data, we have WFA-labeled perineuronal nets that ensheath parvalbumin neurons to a lesser extent in human with respect to rodents. They are decreased in several brain regions in schizophrenia and in a more restricted manner in bipolar disorder. And in the human brain, WFA also labels a population of astrocytes in specific brain regions, and these we found to be increased in schizophrenia. So at that point, we were trying to figure out, okay, WFA does label some CSPGs, but it doesn't tell us which one they are. So I thought this was going to be easy because I could buy a bunch of antibodies against the different protein components of CSPGs, test them all, figure out which one it is, and I was done with my grant. It turns out not to be the case at all. So we did find that there is a decrease of perineuronal nets. I'm actually showing glia here, but they are both decreased in the amygdala of people with schizophrenia. So if you look at aggrecan, one of the most, so with an antibody against the protein core, one of the most well-represented CSPGs in the brain, you do see some small decreases of perineuronal nets. So it could be that, but it doesn't really do it. It's not as extensive as what we have observed with WFA, and it, in contrast to WFA, we find a decrease in glial cells expressing aggrecan instead of a increase the way we found with, here are my perineuronal nets actually. So then we started looking at antibodies, which are particularly interesting again because of the sulfation patterns, may be really what is conferring molecules, these molecules, a lot of their function. So we started looking at sulfation patterns. And we used two different antibodies, as I was showing you earlier, CS56 and 3B3, which are both against CS6 sulfation patterns on the sugar chains. They do differ in labeling, sort of supporting the idea that it is possibly two different spots in the chain. And what we found is CS3B3, that it, in the amygdala, in other brain regions in human, not only labels perineuronal net, but it labels these really curious creatures which correspond to those clusters or dandelion clock that have been described. And at the beginning, we didn't really understand what we were looking at, but eventually we got really curious, so toward the end of this talk, I'm going to show you a little bit what we know about them. CS56 only labels this, which we call CS6 clusters. Dandelion clocks works just as well, but not the perineuronal nets. So we looked at them in various different ways. So in red, this is again 3B3, is one of these clusters with its perineuronal net dipping into it, and it has several glial cells around. We were trying to understand what is the relationship between glia and these clusters. But what we do know is that both types, CS56 and 3B3 labeled clusters, are quite profoundly decreased in people with schizophrenia and in great part in bipolar disorder as well. So, and you see that it is, this is showing the clusters, but it's the same thing for perineuronal nets with 3B3. And you see that it is, at least in the amygdala, much more extensive, so it covers quite a few nuclei as opposed to just the lateral, that the way we have seen it with WFA. So again, we got curious about them and we started trying to understand what they are. We knew some information from work in rodent that had been done. We looked, this is actually non-human primate, just to show, and this is just part of the prefrontal cortex, just to show how many they are. So they are not just a chance, they are not something that you find once in a while, but they are all over the place, although in some brain regions more than others. And this is actually in the rat this time, hippocampus, in which the red is these clusters, and the green is parvalbumin, and the blue is DAPI, to show that there may be a relationship between the processes of parvalbumin-positive neurons and these clusters. And again, they have been described by this group, and they have done actually quite a beautiful work in trying to show that they do affect synaptic transmissions. What we found is that these situations, so in which you have these clusters and a lot of neurons inside, it's true only for certain brain regions, but not all brain regions. In fact, this is not that, it's less often in our hands, but we are still working on it. But something that we were really interested in and it sort of gave us a clue is that at least with 3B3, we would often see a perineuronal net going into the cluster. And we started wondering why that was and what was the relationship between the two. And eventually we thought, well, perhaps it is because some interneurons that might have perineuronal nets, such as those expressing parvalbumin, but also CCK or somatostatin, may send their axons within the clusters. And so the idea, the hypothesis we have been working on is that these clusters are sort of the equivalent of perineuronal nets in the sense that they may be perisynaptic aggregates, but instead of being on one cell only or on different or on many cells on dendrite from different neurons that are sort of dipping into these clusters. So we did some double labeling. This is difficult to see, but you'll understand what I'm showing in the next slide. But it is a double labeling with two colors. So the brown is CS56, but the black is parvalbumin, and it shows quite nicely that there might be a lot of the terminals within the cluster. And I have a couple of examples. So this is again parvalbumin. You see the cells stained and sending processes to two of these clusters, and you see it again. It's probably hard to see, but you can follow these processes dipping into the cluster and some of the labeling for parvalbumin also within the cluster. So, and this is the last thing that I have. The question is if our hypothesis is correct and there are these clusters may be another form of structured perisynaptic extracellular matrix, except that again it affects several dendrites from different neurons, we should be able to see it ultrastructurally around dendrites. And so this is, it's a very thin sections, as you can imagine. It's a photocomposite. So it is many different EM, electromicroscopy photos stitched together. But even though if it is a very thin section, you can still see a lot of these little branches that we observe in the full picture. And when you, and I don't know if you see it, I probably colored it to blue, to light, but I was trying to highlight the where the dendrites are, and you can see that it is in fact packed full of dendrites. Not as many cell bodies in here, but in other brain regions you do find them. I have an example from the hippocampus that has a similar sort of more cell bodies. This is actually not human, by the way, this is rodent. But in the majority of those that we found, you see a many different dendrites, and you do see that the labeling, which is CS56, tends to be around the dendrites. So when we then look at each of these photos, and I don't know if you can really see them, what we see is that there is a lot of labeling, what seems to be the postsynaptic density of a lot of these synapses within the clusters. And please note that this is not, it's immunostained, but it's not stained, such as with uranyl acetate or other things. So you don't see the structure very well, but the reason is because we were trying not to obscure the immunolabeling precipitates. But you see many examples of postsynaptic labeling. But you also see what we believe, and it would be consistent with the reporting of the other group I showed you, potentially the end feet of astrocytes that may also be either labeled or having labeling around them. And the reason we think that is that oftentimes, and I don't know if I have a good example here, we see labeling near the intermediate filament, that may be the, again, the end feet of us, glial cells. So you see this quite a bit here, but you see a beautiful synapse here with this presynaptic and postsynaptic, with a lot of labeling around the postsynaptic density. There is another one somewhere here. But you also see this, and again, mingled with intermediate filaments. There is another example of a synapse. Wait, is this that? Well, so anyways, in conclusion, we think that multiple CSPGs are altered in schizophrenia and bipolar disorder in several brain regions, such as the amygdala, the entorhinal cortex, the prefrontal cortex, and the thalamus. These extracellular matrix abnormalities impact perineuronal nets as well as glial cells and CSCs clusters, which are profoundly decreased in people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And linking back to the idea that, again, this extracellular matrix component may play a key role in synaptic functions and synaptic formation, we believe that these changes may reflect or contribute to altered synaptic functions in these disorders. And with this, I would like to acknowledge people in my lab, as I had them before, the Brain Bank, NIH for funding, and of course you for your attention.